Let's call the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it's about 7 minutes until 2 o'clock in the afternoon on this Tuesday, March 30th, 2010. Let the record reflect that there is a quorum. Present are to my right Senator Thomas, and to my left Senator Davis, and myself Senator Pascavan. I expect both Senator Meyer and Senator Bundy to be here shortly. We just got off the general floor of the Senate, and so we're convening a little bit later than normal, but that's the reason. Anyway, the purpose of our meeting today is threefold. First, we will take up House Bill 377 relating to volunteer amateur sports officials. It is my intent to hear from the sponsor in public testimony, then move House Bill 377 from this committee. Next, we will review the governor's appointments and forward them to a joint session for consideration. I have requested a statement from Mr. T.W. Patch, nominated for the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. And finally, the third task today is Senate Bill 298 relating to state employee geographic pay differential. It is my intent to hear this bill and hold it for additional consideration. But with that in mind, we should begin. And very much welcome Representative Bill Stoltz here to present the merits of House Bill 377 relating to volunteer amateur sports officials. And with Representative Stoltz, we welcome also his staff member. And so if the two of you could please identify yourselves and state your affiliation and then present the testimony.
Bill Stoltz, House District 16, communities of Chugiak and southern rural Mat-Su.
I'm Morgan Hopps, and I am staff to Representative Bill Stoltz.
Thank you very much. Please proceed.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And I appreciate the burst of enthusiasm amongst your Senate membership and co-sponsoring this. I appreciate that, and I appreciate the speed of which this has reached the calendar. This issue was brought to me by folks active in both South Central and Interior youth sports activities, facing the prospect of finding themselves in the unique situation of becoming something they didn't realize they were, and that was direct employers. The problem doesn't arise as much. It arises out of our enforcement by our State Department of Labor and enforcing and protecting workers from manipulation and protecting their rights, and by strictures of the federal government on what we can and can't do as far as how we exempt volunteers or sports officials. I guess there are certain words that are kind of taboo when you're talking about, and I'm not familiar with labor law, so I want to make sure on the record it volunteers that are engaged in the youth activities. And it was our intent to try to bring forth a vehicle that provided for as much latitude for these volunteer organizations, which are basically scraping just to keep kids on the ice or on the soccer fields and provide the basic scoring and officiating neutral officials, and without and generating all the responsibilities of unemployment tax and. We were given a pretty short string by the federal government and a $1,500 exemption for volunteer activities, of which there could be a type of compensation provided, not a wage, but a stipend or per diem type compensations. And that's what we're dealing with. I would much prefer a broader approach, but our hands are tied by the federal law. And I know you and your staff have done a lot of work on this, and you're through both as a senator and because of your activities in youth sports. And I understand it's not unusual for people to have an involvement in youth sports. It's real easy in Alaska to be involved in that, and whether you're a parent or not, that's one of my passions. And I am trying to ASAA, the Alaska School Activities Association, was the main entity that brought this forward, and certainly it's avalanched into other folks presenting their interest. And this is our best effort. It will not solve everybody's problems and issues, but it's our best effort to take care of many of the folks that want to be involved in officiating activities for some pretty insignificant compensation levels without bringing in the reaches of government and all the requirements and to these activities. So
If I could interject, Representative Stoltz, you know, a lot of the people that may be listening today or, you know, want to find out where the $1,500 amount was determined, if I'm understanding what you're saying, then this is a cap that's imposed by the federal government?
This, Mr. Chairman, is the highest level we get. We ran every possible scenario number, and I have to really commend our Department of Labor staff for I certainly had no idea how to get hold of federal officials, and with the efficiency and speed of which they did, and contacted both on the West Coast offices and in D.C., I have certainly have developed a new level of respect for you know, the complication of their work and what they did to help out this situation here in Alaska.
Thank you. And I would like the record to reflect we have been joined by Senator Bundy. And so anyway, please feel free to continue.
Perhaps, well, she's worked real hard on her presentation. If we just kind of go through the bill.
Certainly. So please again state your name and affiliation just so that everyone knows who's speaking.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senators. My name is Morgan Hobson. Again, I am staff to Representative Bill Stoltz. Just to give an overview on the bill, the intent of the bill is to help folks who, not folks who referee as full-time jobs, but people who volunteer their time at local events, sporting events, and receive money to cover incidentals such as food and travel. And these volunteers cover many of their own expenses, including training, certification, costs associated with their officials' organizations, uniforms, and this is purely an avocation that they perform for the sake of community sports. These would only apply to volunteers who receive less than $1,500 total, and that is cumulative over all sports that they may be involved with or all sporting affiliations or organizations. And as the representative said, this cannot be raised, although we've had a great deal of input from folks saying that it would be beneficial to have a higher amount. And again, if we were to raise it above that, the state would lose funding for unemployment insurance, so it's not a possibility. And sports officials, whether they're volunteers, amateurs, cannot be entirely exempted from unemployment insurance, but this gives some leeway to help out folks who do this maybe for several games in the summer or to help out with a son or daughter or grandchild's sporting event. So if I can answer any additional questions too, please feel free to ask.
Certainly, Senator Bundy.
Thank you. I have received several communications from people supporting this. But nothing from people who are opposing it. Can you tell me, is there any opposition?
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, from our experience, the only concerns that we have had have been folks expressing the desire to have a higher limit on this. And unfortunately, we've looked into this to great detail, and it's not a possibility.
And Senator Bundy, through Chair Passfan, the opposition, and it's been in certainly in legal form from the federal government, and providing the broader exemption, we would have liked to have been a little more encompassing. So that's been, but we haven't run into any anti-kid folks here. But bear it out, Derek.
Senator Bundy, you may continue.
Yeah, well, just don't make them cry when you find them. One of the discussions is, of course, workers' comp, and if someone who's volunteering and is injured, I assume these various groups have liability insurance that would cover that event.
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, workers' comp would be an issue entirely external of this, so that would be through the organization.
And I believe ASAA, Senator Bundy, through Chair Passfan, is going to testify. I believe they do carry workers' comp, and you know, they have. But I'll leave that to his testimony. We're hitting a narrow scope of this, but there are people that are more conversant on that issue and can tell you what organizations do and don't. That is an obvious concern.
Yeah, I'll save a question for them. Thank you.
Question that I would have is, since this bill is designed to address the unemployment insurance, is it possible for one of these officials to receive unemployment insurance? And if so, what are the conditions that might be required to receive unemployment insurance?
Mr. Chair, I think there's a more knowledgeable person sitting behind me. We can defer that question. Not I think, I know there's a more knowledgeable person behind me.
Well, thank you, Representative Stoltz, and your assistant, Morgan. Senator Thomas has a question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The $1,500, I understand that is related to some federal requirements. Is that the concern there? And will it be necessary or even a good idea for the various, whether it's soccer association or whatever, whoever might be considered the employer or the person at least paying the individuals that do this, be suggested that they fill out some kind of contract with the individual acknowledging that they're a volunteer and setting out some of the standards so that there will not be some confusion at a later date with any relationship that existed?
Senator Thomas, I forget where I'm at sometimes. Senator Thomas, through Chair Passfan, I think I'm going to work with the Department of Labor too, and through our sports official organizations. That's the issue. They're not employees of the school districts or the associations. They're usually dispatched through an officials association who do this. They don't do it to get rich or to make money. They do it out of love of the sport and to stay involved, and something I hope to get more involved with when I'm not doing other things as I'm doing now. But that's a very good suggestion for Department of Labor and the entities who are advocating this to work together on communicating what the standards and requirements are, because I don't want to create a new confusion in people just because we've passed a statute, hopefully.
Yeah, very good. Thank you.
Thank the two of you, and we would
we'll stay
Paula
here.
Scavera, thank you, Representative Stoltz. Paula Scavera and Bill Kramer, if either or both of you please identify yourselves and state your affiliation, and the record should reflect that we are have Senator Meyer that is with us, and so the floor is yours.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Paula Scavera. I'm the Special Assistant Legislative Liaison of the Alaska Department of Labor.
I'm Bill Kramer, Chief Unemployment Insurance for the department.
Okay, thank you. And Senator Bundy, did you have a question that?
Yes, thank you. I'm all in favor of the bill. I'll start out with that, and helping these young people pick up an extra buck with what they're doing. They're basically volunteering. But sometimes pushback from people who do activities like this for a living, and they feel like their opportunity to make a living is being undercut. My question earlier was that if they were full-time employees, there'd be some workers' comp involved if there was an injury. And having watched young soccer players, there's always that opportunity. I know there's some liability coverage for the players, but what kind of liability coverage is there for these part-time workers?
For the record, Paula Scavera, I'm not the worker comp director, but I asked this question of the workers. Volunteers are volunteers, and they're exempt from worker comp laws. If somebody is a full-time employee, then there's workers comp. The people we're talking about in this bill is volunteers, not full-time employees.
And that's a little bit of my problem. It's a contradiction in terms. When I volunteer to do something, I do it gratis. When I volunteer or I choose to do something and get paid for it, I'm no longer a volunteer.
Well, through the chair, Senator Bundy, these are not considered wages. These are, they get their uniform cleaned. They get a new rule book reimbursed. We're not paying them wages. It's not considered wages. It's, if you look in the Sorry. I only have one hand here. Section on page 7 in the bill, it says volunteer work means work for which compensation does not exceed and is paid only to defray or reimburse the reasonable food, travel, and incidental expenses the person incurs in order to perform the work. The word wages isn't there.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Chairman, yeah, I'm more familiar with it being labeled as an honorarium. So
yeah.
All right.
I'm not a drafting attorney. That's the way it was drafted.
The question that I had is it possible, you know, we're dealing with the unemployment insurance fund, and so is it possible that we would exempt them, but then they could still recover under the unemployment insurance?
Mr. Chairman, if someone has covered wages and in the system and then they file an unemployment claim, they could draw unemployment benefits based on those wages. If there's reimbursement for expenses and travel expenses, uniform allowances, things like that, those things are not considered wages, and they're not taxable, and so they would not help someone qualify for a claim. So if it's actual wages and they're covered, they could be used to help someone qualify for an unemployment claim.
Thank you. Any other questions of these two people? Thank you. I know that we have one other, and you're welcome to stay there if you'd like. Maybe not, but we have one person off-site from the Kenai Legislative Information Office, Richard Wazenin. Is that the correct pronunciation of your name?
Yes, it is. Richard Wazenin. Thank you.
And state your affiliation and provide your testimony.
Okay, my affiliation would be I'm a certified USA hockey official. I'm a certified National Federation High School hockey official. I'm a volunteer local supervisor and trainer for USA Hockey that trains hockey officials. I also sit on the board of directors of our local hockey referee association. So I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to give some input on HB 377. As with every bill passed, we need to avoid any unintended consequences as a result of passing the bill. If this bill passed as written, it's not going to alleviate the current problem that's forcing sport programs to cut back due to the increased cost of obtaining officials for their games. In the case of our Hockey Referee Association, we supply officials for everything from youth hockey to varsity, junior varsity, at the high school level, and adult leagues. If we have to charge each group the extra fees to cover unemployment and a workman comp for these games, it's going to be quite expensive to the programs. The $1,500 threshold only adds confusion. Anytime a ref has assigned the game, we have to charge the league for those fees and might have no idea which person that is going to bid for the job will be able to pass that threshold in their year. The contract that we have with our officials indicates that they are working for us as an independent contractor and as such would not be required to withhold any workman's comp or unemployment compensation. This is done as we set up our nonprofit organization with the help of an attorney to go through the IRS regulations and to include the statement that they are independent contractors. In our association, we pay out between $35,000 and $40,000 a year to about approximately 50 different officials. That's a total amount for the year. With these regulations and having to look at workman's comp and unemployment compensation, we are looking at hiring an accountant that's going to add an extra $10,000 to the fees that we have to charge the associations. At present, we've had a volunteer treasurer that's handled this, and you know, as independent contractors, there is not as much paperwork that has to be done. We have a number of our young people that officiate boys and girls soccer as well as the hockey program, and many of these will come beyond the $1,500 threshold. Most states that I've worked in treat officials as independent contractors and thus avoid this dilemma completely. I feel that it would be better served if we would look at Title 23, the Labor Workers' Compensation and Employment Practices and Working Conditions, and provide an exemption under State Statute 23.10.055. We already have 17 exemptions for these the Employment Security Act here, and if we added another one, it would be to anyone officiating amateur sports where they are compensated on a per-game basis, would eliminate the problem that we are facing. Sports programs are already very costly, and yet we believe they are important to the welfare and health of our communities. So I would ask your very serious consideration on this matter. You look at those exemptions that are provided now, that you have 17 different exemptions. They include, sport fishing guides, deck hands, taxi cab drivers, none of which would meet the guidelines under the IRS as an independent contractor, but yet the state has chosen to provide an exemption for them. So I feel that sports officials in the state of Alaska, which I feel there are a few that possibly can make up to $10,000 a year, it's just a part-time hobby. We're trying to help the kids out and keep them on a safe and fair environment. So I would recommend that you look at this possibility of changing and adding that exemption under the other section rather than go ahead with House Bill 377 that it is written, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Bundy.
Well, certainly if we could have Representative Stoltz back and ask for his comments about that suggestion. Is this relatively new?
We welcome the sponsor.
Thank you, Chairman Passman, Senator Bundy. My preference, Mr. Chairman, would have been for an exemption. I am following Department of Labor's. I've worked very closely with them and running this through the federal government and what they will allow. That list that was just run through, I have one of my constituents in Chugiak has something that very much resembles a taxi cab. He ran a horseless carriage, which he charges, much like a taxi cab drives. I can't tell you what he's been run through the Department of Labor and through having to go back and pay back fines and stuff. I'm not sure it's as simple as the gentleman and I think on the Kenai Peninsula said. Unless our Department of Law and our Department of Labor are really leading me the wrong way, it's certainly been my impression that they have been expressing a path, lead us on a path that will meet the legal test. And the route I would prefer would be the route that Mr. Wisenin suggested, that we have tried presenting exemptions to the federal government and have been turned down.
I know the experts behind you are motioning, so you're welcome to stay there.
We have Department of Law online, too.
Before Representative Stoltz leaves, if I could.
Yes, Senator Bundy.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it. It appears in previous testimony there's an organization that the volunteer workers work for, but it was my conception that a lot of these teams, they're not hiring out of a main hiring hall. They're getting their volunteer workers from an informal group locally. Chugiak Little League, are they hiring out of a hiring hall like the hockey, or is it just somebody that shows up and volunteers?
Sure. Senator Bundy, through Chair Passman, and that's some of the more organized support. There is generally an officials association, and then they work through them. That's whether it's the Little League in Chugiak, Kinnick Little League, or your hockey association. Certainly USA Hockey is a much bigger and more sophisticated organization. It's built in their expenses, and it makes the operation of a local summer soccer league certainly pale in comparison, or even our traditional little leagues. The expenses and all the activities involved. Hockey is probably the largest and most expensive activity going on, and probably has a larger reliance on officials and of a certain caliber. It's been difficult. This is clearly not going to help everybody. It will provide relief for a large section of the folks. Very clear, as labor can tell you, my preference was to have an exemption for youth sports officials, amateur sports officials, and my intent was for folks doing youth sports. I also don't want to open other doors on and provide abusive contract employees. There certainly that's something I didn't want to open the door that wide. But frankly, we weren't even allowed to crack it, let alone open it. And as anybody that's worked on this issue, as I know the chairman has, it's a real frustrating process because our hands are tied at a level far beyond our borders of our state. But I know there's elaboration with smarter people than me, and that's just about everybody in the room.
Well, thank you, Representative Stoltz. The representative of the Department of Labor have been signaling that they would...
Not so much signaling. For the record, Paula Scavera, Legislative Liaison, Department of Labor. To get to this point, Representative Stoltz's office and I sent three versions of bills to the federal government, four versions of bills to the federal government, to the U.S. Department of Law, Department of Labor, trying to see if this would pass. This would pass. Will this work? And then we ended up looking at all states that had tried to do something, and we found this one. In U.S. Code Title 26, 3309, my brain kind of had to freeze for a while. I remember this now. Nonprofits, governmental entities cannot exempt totally their employees from the Unemployment Insurance Act. And Mr. Kramer is much more knowledgeable on this, but I remember one of the drafts we sent back to first the region of the U.S. Department of Labor, and then back east to Washington, D.C., had that exclusion for, like the gentleman spoke of, and the Federal Department of Labor said, no way, Jose, basically. So we did try, and I think we started in January, James? January? December. We started in December trying to get a bill and get something that the federal government would approve.
Thank you. Any additional questions, Senator Thomas?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm a little confused as to what we're actually considering. People, we talk about volunteers in the bill, yet the information that seems to describe some of the attached information doesn't talk about volunteers at all. It talks about people in two different classifications that are actually independent contractors or employees. So what I realize there's a difference here, but is that what's confusing the situation? I mean, I would think that, and I don't want to make it more complex than it is, but I would think a volunteer is a certain class of employee and an independent contractor is something completely different. So I'm not sure of the relevance of these attachments or what they're here for to begin with. And we're only talking, you had indicated that unemployment is not a problem. You can use this in applying for unemployment. So is workers' compensation the very narrow issue that we're looking at? Or...
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, I didn't provide that article. I haven't even read that article.
I realize that.
And there is a difference between independent contractors and volunteers, and Bill can explain how that works. This bill is just for those volunteers and has nothing really to do with the relationship of contractors and independent contractors and any of those things. It doesn't change the relationship because it isn't even dealing with them at all. There has been, through this whole process, since before December even, I've been talking to people from other states that are trying to do the same thing we're trying to do. And some of them have gone independent contractors, and then later had those struck down by the U.S. Department of Labor. Like I said, I haven't read the article. I don't know what it says. But Bill can explain the difference between an independent contractor situation and an employee and a volunteer if you want him to.
No, because I don't see the relevance of that, but it was attached, so obviously somebody felt it was necessary that we had this information so we could consider it for whatever it was worth, but I don't think it's actually pertinent. So I guess, is there a way of solving the situation that was brought to us by Mr. Weiserman, short of where we're at? I mean, his concern seems to be paying the individuals and somehow keeping track of, which didn't seem like it would be difficult to me, but obviously it must be to them. They do it, keeping track of the pay and when a person hits the $1,500 or something. Is that your understanding of the problem?
And please state your name. And
this is Bill Kramer, Chief Unemployment Insurance for the Alaska Department of Labor, through the chair, Senator Thomas. It would be very difficult. The federal law is very clear that sports officials working for nonprofit organizations, we may not exempt their wages from being covered under the unemployment insurance program. The federal statute, as it is, tries to be very inclusive to provide coverage for workers, and so they want the wages included, and they specifically say that we may not exempt them because they're for a nonprofit organization. The question about employees versus independent contractors gets complicated fairly quickly. Alaska statute's very clear on it, and to meet the level of independent contractor, it's a pretty difficult test, but the law does spell it out, and we do apply that if we're looking at any organization and someone says, oh, no, they're contractors, and if they happen to be up for an audit and we look at it, we go right down through the statute and make the determination. And if they are employees, then the wages should be reported and they should be covered. This House Bill 377, as I understand it and read it, is clarifying that reimbursement for expenses incurred should not be reported as covered wages, and that's accurate, and we have other provisions that provide for that. So as I understand it, it's not wages that are being exempted, it's expenses for reimbursement for expenses that is being clarified that it is should not be wages and should not be taxed.
If I may, and I'll just ask this and then probably not ask anymore because I don't think it's making it any clearer to me. I don't necessarily see this as reimbursement for wages. I think that's something that's just be trying to be used or something. I think it's just somebody's getting paid $1,500 and that's all there is to it. And beyond that point, there's some other things have to take place, I guess, when they get paid $1,700 or $1,800 or $1,900 or whatever it is because they officiated 60 games rather than 50 or something like that. So it seems like a relatively small thing to me that we don't want to make too complex. So I guess I'll just accept that this bill is the solution to it as best we can find, and those officiating organizations will probably have to work on whatever issues that they have. Is that just what we're saying?
Senator Thomas, through the chair, this bill is, as I see it, was for those people like Representative Stoltz or me, who has actually tried to referee a soccer game once, to reimburse us for our gas, our meals, or a uniform, or studying the rule book, the rules. It isn't wages whatsoever. It's to help reimburse the mom and pop organizations. It's not wages. I have a friend who goes through a couple uniforms a year, officiating kids' basketball games. Kids bleed on his shirts or whatever happens, and he has to buy a new shirt. This, well, he can put in to be reimbursed for his uniform.
It's not wages. It's reimbursable expenses.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Any further questions? Any comment by the committee? You know, I think that, and I have no questions. I just was going to make the statement that I thought Representative Stoltz indicated it very well when he said that this is not a solution for everyone. Certainly, it's a more encompassing solution would have liked to have been found, but under federal law, I don't believe that the latitude for that solution exists. And so the question is can anything be done? And within that realm of can anything be done, this is probably the best that can be done. And I think that Representative Stoltz, I know that in looking into this, it's certainly not easy. So anyway, given that, I certainly, is there any other comments from any of the other committee members? Senator Davis.
I don't have a comment, but I heard that somebody from law online are here.
Is that?
And I wonder, could they add any clarification to what's been stated? Anybody?
They're not on.
Oh, I thought you said there were. Okay.
Supposed to be.
Not a problem. I don't need them. I just thought if they were there, we might as well hear from them.
They're being paid, that's right.
But other than that, I'm okay.
Okay. Given that, I would accept the motion to move House Bill 377.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I move House Bill 377 to the next committee of referral with individual recommendations and the attached zero fiscal note.
Any objections? Seeing none, House Bill 377 has been moved from Senate Labor and Commerce. We'll take a brief at ease for signature. Bring Senate Labor and Commerce back to order. Mr. T.W. Patch has been nominated by the governor to serve on the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. Mr. Patch, I believe, is joining us from the Legislative Information Office at Anchorage. And Mr. Patch, we welcome you to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. And please state your name and your current affiliation, and then provide the statement that you would like to make to this committee. And then if there are questions by the committee members, please be available to respond. So,
Chairman Pasquin, Vice Chairman Thomas.
Welcome.
Members of the committee, thank you for scheduling this opportunity for me to introduce myself to you to attempt to answer questions you might have. I am T.W. Patch. It is an honor to be selected by Governor Parnell to serve the people of Alaska as a commissioner on the Regulatory Commission. And while I am honored, I'm also humbled as I reflect upon the importance and the magnitude of the task the RCA shoulders each day, and as I examine how best I can make positive contributions as a commissioner. I certainly look forward to serving Alaska's citizens. While I have been an RCA employee, I've seen its very fine staff serve both the utility constituency and the ratepayers of the state. I am confident that capable and dedicated service will continue long into the future. I know that there are many challenges ahead of the RCA, and I am aware that the RCA will face some of those challenges quite soon. I look forward to addressing those challenges while serving as a commissioner. In meeting those challenges, I pledge to you, as I have pledged to Governor Parnell, my focused and determined efforts to carefully analyze those matters brought before the Commission. I certainly intend to decide proceedings on a developed record. I hope to be repeatedly accused of logical analysis and of carefully weighing important facts as cases are decided. I will always apply the enacted, decided, or otherwise relevant law to every proceeding, and I will hope that as we all do this, if any decision is reviewed, whether by you, by a utility, a ratepayer, or a court, by whoever is reviewing an RCA decision, that it will be apparent that hard work and honest effort was part of the decision. I intend to be mindful that clarity of rationale is necessary for any decision to be understood and accepted. Not knowing what goes into sausage or laws or an RCA decision is perhaps a smile-invoking comment, but it is not the best way to set utility rates, nor is it the best way to determine policy that affects legitimate public concerns. I will work to make the rationale of every decision evident and the process that the RCA uses to arrive at its decisions transparent. I am committed to the highest standards of clarity in any communication, and I am likewise committed to consistent application of policy decisions. Carefully crafted policy decisions uniformly applied is the best way to provide predictability of result and is the best way to avoid the legal snare along the pathway where hard cases make bad law. I am eager to begin my service. I look forward with energy and optimism to expanding my knowledge across the spectrum of utility regulation. I do not come before you today pretending to be all knowledgeable in every aspect of utility or pipeline regulation. I hope that during my term, the challenges the Commission faces will be met and beneficially resolved. I believe that my efforts and experiences, blended with the collective wisdom of other commissioners, all of us acting within the framework of your statutory guidance, can help surmount the coming challenges and benefit Alaska's citizens in every place they live and work. In terms of my personal history and my relationship with Alaska, I began hearing about Alaska when I was a small boy. My father had been assigned here before World War II as a member of the Army Air Corps. He was, among other things, a squadron commander and a pilot examiner for the then Civil Aeronautics Board. He gave pilot qualification check rides to a few of our past Noble residents. That list includes Noel Ween, Bob Reeve, Thrillum, Chillum, No Killum, Gillum, and former Governor Egan. My father has fond memories of his time in what was the territory of Alaska. He has fond memories of Alaska as a state as well, as he managed to catch a 50-pound king salmon while visiting a couple of years ago. While growing up, I heard story after story about Alaska. those stories fired my imagination and, joined with other matters, led me to Alaska. I first came here in 1971, and in time, I asked the Air Force to assign me to Elmendorf Air Force Base. I arrived at Elmendorf in 1974, and Alaska has been my home ever since. Since I arrived in Alaska, I've been to every corner of the state. I've worked as a sergeant-at-arms in Native Corporation meetings in Barrow. I've served as a court-appointed special master in Nenana. I arbitrated cases in Haines and Skagway. I've investigated matters for the RCA in Klawak, Juneau, Igigik, and on ADAC. I helped build housing in Point Hope. I performed pro bono legal services in Anaktuvik Pass. I helped salvage a sunken fishing vessel from the Shelikof Straits, and I cooked on a crab boat fishing in the Bering Sea. There is no part of this state where I have not appreciated the rich tapestry of culture that is the heritage of Alaskans. I am appreciative of the state's beauty and character by virtue of my exposure to its people. I hope I am aware as well of the needs of its people in some measure as they live a safe and quality life and see their dreams for prosperity and health realized. I have a deep fondness for rural Alaska. In terms of my profession as an attorney, I took the Alaska Bar Examination after arriving in Alaska. I was admitted to practice in 1975. Of my 38 years' work as an attorney in both government service and in private practice, 35 years have been here in Alaska. My law practice in Alaska over time involved criminal and civil litigation, as well as transactional work. For a long while, a significant part of my practice was as a professional in dispute resolution. I have served both as an arbitrator and a mediator. I earned membership on several national hearing panels, including the Arbitrators Panel of the Federal Mediation and Conciliation Service and the Arbitrators Panel of the National Transportation Board. I served as an arbitrator in other states as well, and on labor and interest arbitration panels here in Alaska. The training and service experience necessary to advance to chairmanship responsibilities and senior status on national panels has, I believe, assisted in my development as a patient yet critical listener. It has also helped me in continuously honing the skills necessary to analyze facts and apply law. That experience has emboldened me in deciding issues of the magnitude so often seen in proceedings before the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. My service with the RCA, the exposure to the agency's enabling legislation and its regulations, has further qualified me to participate in a meaningful role in much of the work that the RCA performs. While serving as an administrative law judge, I have been exposed to a broad array of RCA dockets, some involving rather more routine matters and some involving matters of significantly greater importance. As you are aware, the RCA has processed on average just under 600 tariff filings per year over the past 5 years. It has dealt with an average of 425 consumer protection matters per year over that same period. I believe that the RCA published about 1,300 orders last year. And today, there are more than 170 open dockets of all types being considered by the agency. It is a very busy work environment, dependent on sound management and a cooperative team of dedicated employees. You may not know the mission statement of the RCA. Its mission is to protect consumer interests and promote economic development. It is a mission statement well within the enabling legislation that you passed when you created the agency. It is a mission statement that suggests we are all consumers of and ratepayers for utility service. And it further suggests that regulated utilities should be seen as an important component in promoting economic growth in Alaska. It is a mission statement I embrace. I very much look forward to working at the RCA in a new role. I believe that with my legal training and my life experience, I will contribute to the thoughtful analysis of complex matters. Everyone at the RCA seeks to promote trust in the agency and inspire confidence and respect in all those who have occasion to deal with the Commission. I share in those goals and will work towards that end. In conclusion, I hope to bring my legal experience and perspective to the policy positions the Commission takes and to assist in initiating and developing responses to proposals that involve the needs of customers to safe, efficient, reasonably priced utility service and the needs of companies to earn fair compensation on qualifying investment. I'm happy to attempt to respond to whatever questions you may have. Thank you very much.
Thank you much, Mr. Patch. Any questions by any committee member? Senator Thomas has a question. Mr. Patch?
Not necessarily a question. I just want to say I appreciate your statement, your well-thought-out, concise statement, as well as your enthusiasm, and hope that your past experience will do you well. Any committee, any regulatory agency always takes a lot of heat, right or wrong. It seems that you certainly never satisfy even as much as the majority of the folks involved in whatever the question might be. So good luck to you, depending on the confirmation. And like I said, I appreciate your concise statement. Thank you.
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, thank you very much. I'm reminded of Sir Ernest Shackleton's, by your comments, I'm reminded of Sir Ernest Shackleton's advertisement that appeared in London newspapers when he was embarking on an Arctic venture. Men wanted for hazardous journey, small wages, bitter cold, long months of complete darkness, constant danger, safe return doubtful, honor and recognition in case of success.
Volunteers accepted.
Yeah. Well said. I note that you are in your 38th year, and I'm in my 30th year as in the legal profession, and I know a number of the people that are on your reference list, so you do come with the highest recommendations from these people, and I think given that, members of the committee, I move to forward all of the names for the various boards on today's agenda from the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee to the full legislative body for consideration. And agreeing to advance the appointees in no way reflects any individual member's intent to vote either for or against them, but again would move to forward them. Any objection thereto? Finding no objection, the names will be so forwarded. So if we'll take a brief recess or brief at ease, excuse me, for purposes. We'll bring Senate Labor and Commerce back to order. We will now have brought before us Senate Bill 298. This relates to the state employee geographic pay differential. We welcome Senator Egan to present the merits of Senate Bill 298. He has his able staff here also with him, so we welcome you both. And please state your name and affiliation, and then provide the testimony in the most efficient way as you would wish.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Dennis Egan. I represent Senate District B, which is Juneau. I would like to speak to Senate Bill 298, State Employee Geographic Pay Differential. It has been introduced by myself at the urging of constituents. The Palin administration commissioned the GeoDiff study back in 2008, but has declined to introduce the bill to date. Regional differences in the cost of living change drastically over time, and the last date of a state statute update on geodifferential salaries was over a quarter of a century ago. Senate Bill 298 will bring the geographic differential statute up to date, and I believe, and many citizens of this community of the state believe, that it's a matter of fairness. I have Dana Owen on my staff to explain it further and offer information. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Owen, please state your name and affiliation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dana Owen. I'm staff of Senator Egan. As Senator Egan pointed out, the regional differences in cost of living do change over time, and it's been 25 years since we visited this issue. And we believe that serious pay inequities develop over that time, and that this inhibits recruitment and retention in certain areas of the state. And it's probably time to begin the discussion to fix this problem. We last amended the statute in 1985. And when the Palin administration requested the study, McDowell was charged with looking at differences in cost of living in various communities across the state and in various regions of the state. Senate Bill 298 incorporates the findings of the McDowell study. The bill follows the current statute, at least the structure of the current statute, in that it uses the same original 19 election districts that are currently embedded in the statute. The bill would change the current statutory approach by substituting the McDowell study's percentage variation for the current stepwise variation that's in statute. Currently, in some districts under the statute, the way the statute recognizes the geographic differential is by applying one or two or three, I think goes up to as many as eight pay steps within that range, within that pay group or that geographic area. And I believe Kevin Brooks is here to answer questions about how that's applied. He can give you more technical details on how they do that now. It's important to note that McDowell recommended a different approach. McDowell's study recommended pooling communities, not in relation to their geography, but rather in relation to their cost of living. The regions that they recommended would have, would have a maximum differential across the region of 10%. Mr. Jim Calvin is here from the McDowell Group, and again, I would refer you to him to answer questions of methodology or the reasoning behind their recommendation. I do note that using the study or using the approach suggested by the McDowell Group raises a new policy question, and that is, how do you pick the number within that difference within their pool? So if within a pool, for instance, if there is a 10% difference, do you split the difference? Do you pick a number that's halfway between the lowest and the highest? Do you take a weighted average, or do you find some other rationale for picking another number within that variation? The approach taken by 298, Senate Bill 298, is the simplest approach. It has the virtue of simplicity and being a structure that people are familiar with today. However, 298 is only intended to be a point of departure, and Senator Egan, in discussions with me, has indicated that he's quite open to considering other methods that the committee may see as superior. And with that, I think I'll cut this short because I know you have questions for others.
Thank you, Mr. O. And any questions for Senator Egan or Mr. Owen? We have at least one person here to testify, Chris Christensen. And I know we have also the member of the McDowell Group, and I don't know whether they want to. Anyway, Chris, please. State your name and affiliation and provide your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Chris Christensen. I'm the Deputy Administrative Director of the Alaska Court System. I appreciate the opportunity to speak on this issue today. This is the third time I can recall having addressed this subject with the legislature. The first time was around 1996 on Senate Bill 152, which failed to pass. Again, in 2002 on Senate Bill 180, which passed but was vetoed by Governor Knowles. Both bills attempted to fix the geographic differential system for non-union employees, and both attempts failed over the details. The legislative focus in 96 and 2002 was finding a way to lower the state's personal services budget, not fixing the inherent unfairness in the current system. The current differential was adopted, I believe, in 1976, while the pipeline was still under construction. Obviously, a lot has changed since then. The executive branch's union contracts, which are renegotiated every 3 years, have not reflected this out-of-date differential since around 1985, although the differentials in the current contracts are apparently also substantially out of date. Now, while the judiciary is a tiny branch, using less than 2% of the state's general fund operating budget, we actually employ about two-thirds of all the non-union employees who are currently getting a geographic differential. We have, as of late last year, we had 266 eligible employees. The executive branch had 190, and the legislative branch had 10. This situation is especially problematic for our employees because most of them are clerical workers at range 10 and 12, whereas many of the executive branch's employees are attorneys in the Department of Law and the Public Defender Agency who get a much higher base salary to live on. Assuming that the differential rates reflected in the McDowell study are accurate, I have clerical employees in rural Alaska, for example, Dillingham, who are being paid as much as 25% less than the actual cost of living. To put it a little differently, those employees are effectively being paid about 25% less than employees in Anchorage for doing the exact same work. Conversely, I have employees in certain urban areas, such as Fairbanks and Palmer, who are effectively being paid 5 to 10% more than Anchorage employees for the exact same work. Now, every year we have gone without fixing this, the unfairness inherent in the current system has made a global fix more difficult, more complicated, and more expensive. It's more expensive because the differential between Anchorage and most rural communities has increased compared to what it was the last time we tried to fix it and the time before that. It's complicated because those employees who are benefiting from a too high differential in their communities, like Fairbanks, have based their economic decisions on their current salaries and the projected longevity increases and cost of living adjustments granted by the legislature. They've based them on these economic decisions, like their mortgages, their car payments, and the rate at which they save for retirement for their children's education. Under those circumstances, we do think it would be unfair to reduce the differential of those employees, as was proposed in the past, or even to freeze those employees in place, as the current bill proposes, not giving them any general pay, any merit increases or general pay raises for a period of years. For example, we would have employees in Fairbanks who, under this bill, would be frozen in place for approximately 4 years until their current salaries caught up. We have a few employees along the Parks Highway, I believe in Healy and Anana, who might not get a merit increase for 10 years if this were to pass because their geographic differential has been changed so much. So, Mr. Chairman, just in conclusion, we would urge you to do something that would address the inherent unfairness in the current system.
Thank you, Mr. Christensen. Senator Thomas.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Christensen, for your testimony. And what did you use to determine the differences, the sum that you found, the two that you referenced anyhow, the Bethel area, I believe it was 25% below the Anchorage and Fairbanks 5 to 10%. What did you use?
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, we are those figures were basically from the McDowell study. Those based on what the law currently gives our employees and what the McDowell study would give those employees in those communities.
No, that's fine. I was just looking for, you know, sure, what method you were using, if you were using McDowell or something that you guys had right. Come up with that working on it.
No.
And isn't the real problem here finding a formula that more people will agree with? I mean, obviously, any time you find a situation where somebody sees something going up, they're going to say, well, you know, the employees aren't that familiar with the cost of living someplace else, so they are going to, you know, complain to their representative that they're not being treated as fairly as somebody else. So to me, when I looked at it a couple of times over the years, it seemed to me that it had to be a very comprehensive kind of list of things that you use, and it had to be done the same way every time. If in fact the first time you went through it, people thought it was at least fair, that any changes that took place in it obviously would be considered favoritism for whatever reason. You know, it didn't make any difference what the different people thought, but just that why did this change or that change? Why did we not consider some of the things? And I know that in Fairbanks, I received the complaints that they used a lot of the housing data, and at that point in time when they did it, the military troops were gone, so that applied downward pressure to the housing market as far as what the rents were or sale of houses and whatever what is included in the survey. So I don't know what the answer is, but I know that it sure has a lot of people excited one way or the other.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Thomas, I don't know if the committee ever received any a letter from the Association of Alaska Magistrates. That's a private group made up of most of the magistrates in Alaska, and they had contacted us and said they were very concerned about the legislation, or actually concerned about the McDowell study, because they disagreed with some of the methodology and the way it affected certain communities. I think you're right. Trying to decide what is fair is sometimes is the most difficult thing to do. Fairness should be easy, but a lot of the time it isn't.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bundy.
Yeah, thank you. You're right. Sometimes the best we can do is make everybody a little bit mad. You had suggested that now we've got two groups, one displaced from the other, and we can hold, you know, the upper one in place until the lower one catches up, but you said that's not fair. What would you suggest as a solution then? Give everybody a raise, but some less than others?
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, our preferred method would be to take those persons who are currently being paid substantially less than the cost of living relative to Anchorage and give them a raise, and take those other persons who are being paid too much, and not decrease their pay or freeze them in place. We would allow, the court system actually has a great deal of turnover. We have turnover of about 10% a year. If we were to not freeze these people in place or reduce their costs, the costs for a fiscal note would be the same the first year either way. The costs would go down more slowly if we allow these people to retain their current salaries and continue to get merit increases. One problem we have, you know, we do have a merit system in place in Alaska that gives annual merit increases to employees. And I'm not sure how they do things in the executive branch. In the court system, we actually do use the merit increase as a merit increase. We do withhold it if people aren't performing adequately. And when you tell people that you're not going to be eligible for merit increases for 4 to 10 years because of this change in the law, you have to wonder what's going to happen in your organization. So there are practical problems.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I observed, and I'm sure you meant, people who get paid too much according to the McDowell study. I think there are very few state employees who think they get paid too much.
Yes, sir.
Any further questions of the, by the committee of Mr. Christensen? We thank you, Mr. Christensen. I know that we do have the member of the McDowell Group here. I see that you're not signed up, but
Mr. Chairman, I don't have any prepared comments. I'm happy to answer questions about the study if there are questions.
Sure. I know. I think addressing one of the questions Senator Thomas had about the housing data in Interior Alaska, I think would be. I know it's a topic of discussion. So please state your name and affiliation, and then we welcome you to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jim Calvin. I'm a principal with the McDowell Group. McDowell Group is the principal research firm involved in the 2008 Alaska Geographic Differential Study. If I might make just a few brief comments about the overall methodology before I address Senator Thomas's question directly. Two primary methodological tasks involved in this project. One was a household survey of 2,500 Alaska households scattered all throughout the state. The purpose of the household survey was to essentially understand the size and shape of the Alaska household budget. That is, how important is housing in the household budget? How important is food, transportation, medical care, clothing, furniture, etc. In terms of the share of each of those in the household budget, is housing 30% of the household budget in Fairbanks, or is it 25, or is it 35? And the same thing in Bethel, and the same thing in Juneau. So that was sort of the first key research task that we undertook. The second was a retail price survey conducted in over 600 retail outlets throughout the state and 58 different communities. I should add that the household survey covered 74 communities across the state. Now, the point of the retail price survey was to understand the differences in prices between a market basket of about 200 items throughout the state. You know, price of a loaf of bread in Angoon versus the prices of a loaf of bread in Anchorage, for example, or contact lenses or toothpaste, the broad spectrum of a typical household market basket items. So it was the blending of those two sets of data together that allowed us to produce these differentials. A couple other quick background points. I do want to make it clear that we never addressed nor implied that anyone was being overpaid in state government. In fact, we didn't measure the cost of living. We measured the differences in cost of living between Anchorage as the base community and a differential of one, and all of in a range of other districts. So the the equity of pay overall is not part of what we were trying to do, and certainly don't want there to be the assumption that we suggest that folks anyplace are being overpaid. One last methodological background point: we initially defined. We departed from the election district structure of the previous differential and focused on instead on defining geographic differential pools, which are essentially collections of communities that exhibit like characteristics in terms of size. Typically, smaller communities have higher cost of living than larger communities. In terms of geographic location, obviously there are climactic issues and others. A small rural community in southeast Alaska faces different issues than a small community in northwest Alaska. And most important, grouped communities according to their transportation infrastructure. I think one of the overarching conclusions of this study is that if you're on a road system, you're in a very different situation than if you're off a road system. Small southeast communities are in a little bit different situation because they have ferry service, but road access is a critical, probably the most critical aspect in the cost of living. Now, specifically to Senator Thomas's issues about the Fairbanks economy and the deployment of troops from the area and what impact that might have had, certainly some impact on the economy, no doubt about that. Need to keep in mind, however, that typically about 60% of the residents in a community own their own home. So a deployment such as what we saw there doesn't affect anybody's mortgage payment. It would only affect rental payments if someone were typical renter were moving during the period and moving into a different rental situation. New people coming into town might have experienced slightly lower rents if the property values were slightly lower. But overall, if you think of the slice of the population that might have been affected because they were moving in or out of the community, pretty small. Again, given no one's mortgage changed as a result. If you bought a new house during this time, perhaps you got a little bit lower price on your house. But again, the turnover in the community is relatively low. And again, housing is typically about a third of the household budget. So some minor variation in that aspect of the household budget is possible. But we don't see that as having any meaningful impact on the differential. And again, what matters is your transportation infrastructure. And they've got great transportation infrastructure in Fairbanks. So they're essentially, they have the same overall cost of living as Anchorage and many other communities on a highway system. That's our fundamental conclusion anyway.
Senator Thomas.
I appreciate that and probably would agree with you that there may not have been the greatest impact from that, but I'm just curious about how you assign values to these things when you go through it, because to me, I don't know what the rents and the housing costs are in Anchorage, and I'm sure they vary dramatically from one part of town to another. So if you actually use brackets of folks by their income, because I would assume that makes a difference in where somebody shops and what they buy, and maybe that's not a consideration. So I'm somewhat unfamiliar with the entire process of what you go through, other than what I looked at, and to some degree I was a little surprised at the process. Fuel is extremely volatile in Fairbanks. It's not volatile in Anchorage. It's natural gas, and it is what it is, and they change a contract every now and then, but fuel in Fairbanks, 1 year is $5,000 to buy fuel for your house, and the next year it might be $2,500 because it went up to $4.50, $5.50, and then of course the rural areas are even a huger impact. And to me, I could care less about the cost of a tube of toothpaste compared to the rent and the insurance and the electricity and the fuel, and the fuel affecting the electricity is another huge factor, because we have a surcharge in Fairbanks, which I guess you guys are hopefully aware of, that doubled the electric costs last year. That and it still exists now as they're paying off. So that made my electric bill go from $100 a month to $200 a month. And my fuel bill, for my car and for the house, basically doubled as well, So I had difficulty with the entire thing, understanding the methodology, and I don't expect you to explain it to me here today, but it just seemed to me like the same comment I made earlier, that there would be a relatively fair way of establishing it, and then some adjustment have to be made for not only up but for down. And if you did it in 08 and then 09 hit, no wonder people got excited, because they probably looked at your survey and compared it to what took place in 09 and said, this doesn't even make sense, because the cost of fuel went way up and there were a variety of other things that impacted the economy. So I'm not so worried about the toothpaste and the can of Campbell's soup, in that relationship. I'm more concerned about the big ticket items that are influenced by economic changes that change so dramatically and make such a huge impact on it that do cause, you might even consider an overreaction to the situation because of what took place. But whether it's an overreaction or not, somebody is suffering that huge change, particularly in the fuel costs, and those all relate to the housing aspect, and I'm not sure how you broke that down, quite honestly.
Senator Thomas, through the chair, lots of ground with that comment. Let me start by saying that the basic methodology in the survey was to measure the cost of housing, for example, as people experience it in each community. Clearly, there's very different, big differences in the size of the typical home in Anchorage and the quality of the typical home in Anchorage than there is in Fort Yukon, for example. Our challenge was to compare how people live in Anchorage versus how they live in Yukon, and look at how important housing is and the cost of housing in Fort Yukon versus the cost of housing in Anchorage, and see how it fits into the household budget. You're right, toothpaste is inconsequential. It is, housing is the single most important factor, and housing is the size of mortgages, which are high in Anchorage. Urban areas typically have higher mortgage rates, higher housing costs. Anchorage's housing costs are amongst the highest in the state. So using Anchorage as the base doesn't mean it's the lowest cost by any stretch of the imagination for all aspects of the household budget. What other questions can I answer?
Well, I think that to me that's the biggest one. How you settle on particular items that are indicative of what the nature of the economy is in that specific area, and have some way of adjusting those two, because over a period of time, a lot of things are based on that. Like we're talking about salaries for people based on that. Well, if depending on the timing of it, that is a huge issue. So I brought up that particular because it did have an impact, and we're talking about percents here, 1 or 2%. So even if there was a minor impact to the housing, it is such a big item in your overall budget that would have, when we're talking about worrying about 1, 2, or 3%, could have a huge impact on that kind of a percentage. If we were saying, you know, we're using 20 or 30% before it had some kind of impact on somebody, then that might be a very different situation.
Yeah. Through the chair, Senator.
And just one more, maybe more specific, is the idea of what do you use when you compare, like the heating cost? Do you use just a dollar value, or do you use like the barrel of equivalent, like we like to use or don't like to use, depending on when we're talking about oil taxation, that type of thing, for the heating value that you get out of a certain measure, certain increment of a particular fuel?
Senator Thomas, through the chair, again, what we used was what people paid, regardless of, we collected a great deal of data on the cost of fuel in each community, and for diesel fuel, home heating fuel, for gasoline, and so forth. So we collected a lot of data there to help us ground truth our survey research. But again, our fundamental data set, our data collection process, was to find out what people paid. Did you pay $3,000 a year for your home heating fuel in 2008, or did you pay $1,500, and so forth? So it was what they actually paid, regardless of the energy efficiency of their home or the price of the fuel in their community. What did it cost you? How important was it in your household budget? Let me clarify the time frame of our research. We conducted our household survey and all of our secondary research, where we collected price data, in the fall of 2008. The peak of fuel prices was in the summer of 2008. So fuel prices were changing dramatically right during our research effort, but they weren't in a peak. But what we asked people to tell us about was their expenditures for the year, or their average monthly expenditures for the year of 2008. So that's the year that we were interested in. Obviously, fuel prices are highly variable. It interested us to understand if we'd done the study in 2009 or we'd done the study in 2007, what differences might we have seen in these differentials? And there is some sensitivity. If prices had been 30% lower for fuel, there is some moderate amount of sensitivity in the differentials, primarily in the small, remote, rural communities. Not so much, again, Fairbanks might be 1.05 instead of 1.04 or 1.06, relatively moderate. I won't say inconsequential changes, but the sensitivity to prices really is evident in the rural areas, where not only are they paying higher prices for the fuel, but the effect of a spike in fuel prices in Anchorage is multiplied, because first you have to get the fuel out to the community, and then you pay the additional price on that. So it's really a geometric increase in prices when you're looking at a fuel change in Bethel, for example. So very aware of the issues around fuel prices, tested sensitivity of our differentials, found some, but not a significant amount.
If I could ask a question, did the McDowell Group know that the Stryker Brigade had deployed?
Oh, certainly, yes. We keep fairly close track of the economy. You know,
my follow-up question to that is, what is your numbers as far as the population that left Interior Alaska as a result of that deployment?
Oh, I can't tell you that off the top of my head.
Do you have an estimate as to the percentage of the population that left Interior Alaska as a result of the deployment?
If the deployment was 2,000 people, that might be a population change of 3% or so. That's just numbers off the top of my head.
If it was triple the numbers, do you think that that would have an effect upon the immediate effects of selling prices of homes and rental charges?
Certainly the rental market. Again, I'm not, you know, we didn't do a housing market assessment of Fairbanks or Anchorage or Juneau or Ketchikan or any of the other communities in the state. Again, what's meaningful is the turnover in the population, and simply the fact of people leaving is not going to change your mortgage or my mortgage or anyone else's mortgage in the community that you're already living there and you're already paying, nor is it going to change a rent for a renter. I don't think anyone ever experienced a reduction in rent because the population went down. If they moved to a different location or someone new to the community came in, they might be experiencing slightly lower rents than they would if the brigade hadn't left.
So if I'm understanding, you don't believe that rents transiently dropped as a result of the deployment?
Oh, no, I would suggest they probably did. I think that the military certainly has an impact on the rental market, but it didn't change. I wouldn't expect that it changed the rental rates for anyone that was already living in the community pre-renting and living in the community pre-Stryker Brigade deployment. Again, a landlord's not going to just drop his rental rates. So now the guy that loses renters because of the deployment, he might need to offer lower rental rates to someone new coming in.
Certainly I think we thank you, Mr. Calvin. Senator Bundy, we do have another committee coming here, so yeah. Premises.
A quick comment. I wanted to give Senator Thomas some encouragement, a little tongue-in-cheek, knowing that we have a automatic defib thing out here, so Senator Egan will invent he has a big coronary, but look on the bright side. This $6 million fiscal note, the vast majority of it go to Juneau. None of it's going to go to Fairbanks. We just need more state workers in Fairbanks.
We try to accomplish that, but we have difficulty with it, just like
Juneau. You may consider this ammunition for a capital move.
Anyway, I would like to state before we do conclude Senate Labor and Commerce today, I think that this last discussion on Senate Bill 298 shows it's a complex issue. I think, House Bill 377. No, this is 298. There we go. Chris Christensen, I want to thank you for your testimony. I was especially listening to your testimony, and as I said at the start of this, it's raises complex issues. We're going to look at the solutions. We thank the McDowell Group for appearing here today and providing the comments to this committee. With that, Senate Labor and Commerce is adjourned for this Tuesday.